Okay, so for those of you just coming in, welcome. Feel free to ask questions throughout. I'll repeat your question for the benefit of the tapes or recordings that they're doing. But I wanted to keep it casual, so please feel free to raise your hand and we'll be happy to address your questions as they come up. For those of you who are coming back, thanks so much. We're going to talk about soft tissue sarcomas right now. And part of this lecture is sort of combined with some other sort of principle stuff, like how we approach the cancer patient. And soft tissue sarcomas are one of the it's just a good example of a typical way that we work up some of these patients. But a lot of the principles that you'll be learning in this lecture will apply to any type of cancer. So hopefully this will be very practical and helpful to you. So what are soft tissue sarcomas? Well, they arise from the mesenchymal tissue. So these are the non-bone connective tissue, the supporting structures of your body, like the muscles, fascias, nerve sheaths, not necessarily the nerves themselves. And although they almost commonly always occur in the, you know, extremities, trunk, etc., they can also occur in visceral sites, like spleen, for example. They can occur on heart. They can occur in bladder, vagina, etc. There are probably about 15% of all skin and subcutaneous tumors in dogs are usually, you know, they can comprise about 15%. We see them commonly. You see them commonly. And I think that's supposed to say cats. 7% of skin and subcutaneous tumors in cats when we don't count the vaccine-associated or injection site tumors. So some of the things that are kind of challenging about soft tissue sarcomas is that they have so many names. And it's really kind of hard to figure out why they name them differently, and then, you know, what's kind of a worse form and what's kind of a better form. So other names that I have heard people call them on pathology reports or in textbooks or whatever are spindle cell sarcomas, malignant spindle cell tumors, undifferentiated sarcomas, all kinds of weird things like that. The thing that really is the most important thing to remember is that they all pretty much behave the same. So regardless of what they're called, and we'll talk about sort of what's included in this under the general topic of soft tissue sarcomas versus other tumors that have a sarcoma suffix that may not behave the same way. But in this big topic of soft tissue sarcomas, they all behave about the same. And here are the kind of the commonalities, is that their behavior is grade dependent. We grade them from grade 1, 2, or 3. So grade 1 is well differentiated and grade 3 is poorly differentiated. And the poorly differentiated ones have a more aggressive behavior. So that's one thing. They're usually locally invasive, and they have a high rate of local recurrence. They're typically really tricky because they want to shell out, but they actually have little crab legs that go into the tissues around them, so they kind of trick you into wanting to shell them out, and that's actually not the appropriate surgery to do. They typically don't metastasize by lymph node routes. They most commonly metastasize via hematogenous routes, and so therefore they end up in the lungs commonly before they end up in the lymph nodes as a rule, but it's not 100%. And then they are named after the mesenchymal tissue from which they arise, which is why pathologists like to name things. It's like parasitologists, you know, like any of us really care if it's, you know, changes from this name to that name, but pathologists love to name stuff, and so that's why we're stuck with all this. And basically, again, not every tumor that has a sarcoma suffix on the end of it is included in this sort of general catch-all term, soft tissue sarcomas. But the ones that are things like the fibrosarcomas, the peripheral nerve sheath tumors, or malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors, or schwannomas that they used to be called, undifferentiated soft tissue sarcomas, malignant fibrous histiocytoma, which is a weird one, myxosarcomas, liposarcomas. Some people consider synovial cell sarcomas to be under this category. Things that have that sarcoma suffix that don't have that same behavior that we just talked about, locally invasive, slow to metastasize, grade dependent, are these ones. And that's like hemangiosarc, we know, very aggressive, not the same kind of thing. Osteosarcoma, very aggressive, doesn't behave the same way. Chondrosarcoma, it doesn't really behave the same way either. Lymphosarcoma, obviously, that's a misnomer. Lymphoma is the proper name, but people still call lymphosarcoma. Commonly we hear that. It's not a sarcoma. Mast cell tumors, I've heard some pathologists and or old textbooks will refer to them as mastosarcomas. They're not a sarcoma. And melanomas, there are old textbooks or old pathology reports I'll read that say melanosarcoma. Again, not a sarcoma. So just to kind of, you know, confuse the picture further, there's sort of the innies and the outies, and the innies are what we're going to be talking about today, the ones that are included under this common title, soft tissue sarcoma, that have a similar biologic behavior. So their clinical characteristics are similar among all of them. They're usually a fixed, firm mass. They typically are growing pretty slowly. They recur rapidly or more rapidly after excision in some cases. And one of the kind of hallmarks, and we'll talk a little bit about why this is that the more times you excise them, especially if you don't get clean margins, the faster they grow back. And in this case, these are two normal structures in this intact male poodle, and this is the tumor here. And this has had multiple surgical attempts, and part of this tumor is kind of bulging through its old scar site, and then there's a larger tumor underneath. They commonly occur on extremities and trunk. The ones that are the most common that you guys probably see the most of in practice are these peripheral nerve sheath tumors that are usually on the distal extremities, and you know how you try to take them off and they're wrapping around tendons and weird, you know, they're like right near a vessel or something. That's a real common one, and that is a soft tissue sarcoma like the typical soft tissue sarcomas. So, again, talking about just principles that apply to soft tissue sarcomas but also apply to everything else is that whole three questions I always talk about, the big three for the big C, and the questions are what is it, where is it, and how bad is it? And we always want to answer those three questions prior to making any particular therapeutic intervention. And the reason is because we may compromise the optimum treatment pathway for that animal. We might compromise the ability for us to get a cure. So we want to know what we're dealing with. We want to know where else this thing could be. Where are we today? And we want to know how bad is this so we know what appropriate step to take in terms of surgery or chemo or whatever. So again, the what is it question, fine needle aspirate, very, very easy to do. Gives us a ton of information, and it's very, very helpful. You can charge for it. You can get pretty good at reading these with at least getting a hint about what you're dealing with prior to deciding whether this is just a lipoma, and you can schedule surgery for the next day, or maybe this requires a little bit more workup because this could be a malignancy. And then biopsy, which is the gold standard. And there's a lot of ways to biopsy between true cuts and incisional biopsies, etc. So we all know how to do these fine needle aspirates. We know they're rapid. My belief is that any mass that you can localize or stabilize or access, even with ultrasound, aside from, say, bladder tumors, we should probably try to aspirate first. And the reason is because then it gives us a very good clue as to where to look for it elsewhere and also what to do next. I always recommend a pathologist follow-up. I'm not a clinical pathologist, and I'll give you sort of the cytology for dummies version of how I look at it because, again, I am a surgeon, which means that I would fall under that dummies category. So I always follow up with the pathologist just for legal issues. I want that pathology report in the record. Unless it's a lipoma or something, and then I just, you know, we'll just go ahead and write that. And we can do this while the owner waits. So there's a couple ways to do it. You can do it with the needle. Some people like that, with the needle and syringe. Some people just like the needle. One little tip I can give you about just doing it this way, smaller masses, it tends to be easier. And if you cover the hub of the needle with your finger before you pull it out, it tends to keep the cells in there a little bit better, like, you know, soda in the straw like you did when you were a kid. And then you can get more cells typically. And then we just smear them out, and a lot of times what I'll do is I'll save the best slides for the pathologist, and I'll submit those, and I'll just take the ones that are kind of crummy or the one slide I use to smear and diff-quick it and look at it for myself. And anybody know what this is? I hear it, mast cell tumor, right. So, you know, we can do this. We're capable. And so I guess this is sort of my cytology for dummies, or cytology 101 again, or aka cytology for surgeons, because this definitely helps me tailor my diagnostic plan and my staging plan when I know what the cytology results are. So the first question, any lump or bump, stick a needle in it, is it inflammatory or neoplastic? If I get a bunch of neutrophils and pus out, then, you know, then I know it's probably an abscess or something versus, you know, cells that look like this that definitely look like bad actors. There's probably something going on here that I need to be concerned about and maybe want to look into further before just hacking it out or lancing it or whatever. And then if I do think it might be neoplastic, the next question is it benign or malignant? And if it's benign, for example, lipoma, that's going to require one kind of set of surgery, one sort of surgical dose. And then if it's malignant, that might require a larger surgical dose. You know, we're used to thinking about the whole dosing concept in, you know, or antibiotics, like bad infection need big gun antibiotics. Wimping infection needs garden variety antibiotics. Bad tumor needs big gun surgery. Wimpy tumor like lipoma needs garden variety surgery. Okay, but I need to know which one I'm going to do because I want to be able to do it right the first time and give that animal the best chance for cure. So then if it's malignant, and this is where sometimes, you know, I need the pathologist, but sometimes I can tell myself. I can really tell whether it's round cell, epithelial cell, or mesenchymal. Round cells are, you know, your mast cell tumors, your lymphomas. The epithelials are your carcinomas, and the mesenchymals are your sarcomas, okay? And that helps me because then I know something about its behavior, and I know where to look for it elsewhere in the body. So just sort of as for fun here, let's just think about, for example, you have a lump, and it's made up of a bunch of epithelial cells, and you stick a needle into it, and you pull some cells out, and you blow them out on a slide. And this is what they look like. And this is an epithelial tumor. These are the three different kinds of tumors that you can get on cytology. So what, you know, the thing that I think about is to help me figure out what this is, I think about, okay, what do epithelial cells do for a living in your body? Well, they make glands. They line things and make watertight barriers. So if I have a whole big lump of these cells and I take them out of their mass and I put them on a slide, typically what they're going to do is they're going to all be together and form these sheets and rafts. And then one of the things that helps me with these is that oftentimes I can see the difference between where one cell cytoplasm ends and the other one begins. And kind of see self-separation. Sometimes I can see those tight junctions. And that's what they're doing. Their epithelial cells are trying to line up and be little soldiers, or they're being glands, or they're doing something like that. And they keep those characteristics even in malignancy unless they're super, super undifferentiated. And so I can tell just by looking at that, that's a sheet that looks like I can see the difference between one cell cytoplasm and the others. I know where one cell ends, the other begins. And then I'm looking for all these features of malignancy that we all learned about, like the, you know, anisokaryosis, anisocytosis, mitotic figures, and things like that. Okay, then if I take a tumor that's full of mesenchymal cells and I stick a needle in and I suck some cells out and blow them out on a slide, what do mesenchymal cells do for a living? So that's how I think of it. Well, they make a stroma, right? Because there are supporting structures. So they make collagen, or they make, you know, adipose tissue, or they make, you know, loose connective tissue or ground substance or something. And so they're making typically this, even when they're malignant, they make this sort of stroma. And so I'm sticking my needle in and I'm tearing those cells out of their stroma environment and blowing them out on a slide. And sometimes if I'm lucky, I might get stroma, but I'm not good enough to figure out what kind of stroma it is. Could it be, you know, bone or collagen or whatever. But I am good enough to be able to say, you know what, these guys, they're not really in a sheet. They have the streaming cytoplasm, which kind of makes sense, right? You're ripping them away from their stroma. And then if I have a whole bunch of them together, and this may not be the best example, but sometimes I just can't see where one cell begins and the other cell ends. Like their cytoplasm kind of all is merged together. They have these oval nuclei. They have features of malignancy. So to me, that looks like a mesenchymal cell. And see, that's how I'm relating it, is what does the normal tissue look like? And so it sort of looks like that. And then round cells, what do they do for a living normally in your body? They circulate, right? That's their job. And whether you're a mast cell or a lymphocyte or whatever, you're circulating. So they don't have a lot of cytoplasm because it's dangerous to be a circulating cell with a lot of cytoplasm because it tends to get pinched off and ruined by just the turbulence of the bloodstream. Big nuclei. They don't seem to have any, like, coherency like these guys do, okay? They just sort of are separate cells. So that's my version of cytology, and that's sort of how I separate them. Remember I said mesenchymal cells tend to metastasize via hematogenous routes. Carcinomas tend to metastasize via lymphatic routes. Where am I going to look for a mesenchymal cell tumor that's on the rear end of a dog? Maybe very different than where I might look for a carcinoma tumor elsewhere in the body that's on the rear end of a dog. So my mesenchymal cells, I'm going to look more at the chest. My carcinomas, I'm going to look more at the sublumbar lymph nodes. Okay? So that's why it helps me tailor my diagnostics, tailors my staging. Okay? There's our sarcoma. So knowing that information, it seems very clear to me that it's such an easy test to do a fine needle aspirate that every externally palpable mass should at least have a fine needle aspirate performed. And the common mistakes that we see all the time that do compromise the treatment pathway for these guys and often compromise our ability to cure these patients is that it looks and palpates like benign, so we either ignore it and then it gets giant, or we remove it before we know what it is. We think it's a lipoma, we don't stick a needle into it, it's been there for a bunch of years, all of a sudden it starts growing, so we just remove it. And in some cases, that may be the end of our ability to cure that patient. And I'll explain why that is. So what I would recommend is, you know, we all have these patients that have a million lumps and bumps on their bodies. And you know, we don't want to, every time the dog comes in for vaccines, aspirate every single lump. And it takes forever to do that. And you know, we know that last year these were lipomas or whatever. So what I would suggest you do is just keep a tumor map. And the first time, and we charge for body maps, like what we'll do is if we have a dog that comes in for a first appointment and has 20 lumps, we charge for a body map, and we actually aspirate all those lumps and measure them, and most of them are going to be lipomas, and most of them are going to be benign in dogs anyway. And then we record those on this sort of body map, and what they are, and their measurement, usually the largest diameter. And the next year, if that dog comes in, if there's been a big change or they're new lumps or I can't remember, I look at the dog's map and I go, okay, yeah, this was a lipoma. This is, and hasn't changed much. I don't need to reaspirate that. So once we have that, if we're doing fine needle aspirates, if we know that they're, whatever we're aspirating is obviously benign, like your lipomas or sebaceous cysts or whatever, we just record it and recheck that annually. If on our body map we get a suspicious fine needle aspirate, then we might want to consider biopsy to get a better diagnosis because we don't know exactly what we're dealing with. And we might want to consider staging, i.e. finding out where else it is in their body. If we know it's malignant, your mast cell tumors, et cetera, then we want to do a complete staging and workup. We may want a biopsy because we may want more information before we choose a treatment about that tumor. But the point is that we want to know what we're getting into before we remove the tumor. That's the most important thing. So fine needle aspirate allows us to have some measure of suspicion or hopefully completely rule out cancer. But most importantly, it allows us to plan the next step. And the questions we should be asking ourselves are, should we obtain a tissue biopsy prior to excising this? Will that be helpful to us? Will that give us more information? Will it change our surgical dose, possibly? Do I know how big to make the surgical margins based on this fine needle aspirate, based on how else the dog is doing? Again, that surgical dose concept, big gun surgery for big gun tumors, wimpy surgery for wimpy tumors. Do you think that we're going to need additional treatment? Do I think I have any shot at getting this out cleanly? Do I need to set the owner up that this may not be excisable with clean margins, and no matter what we do, we may have to ultimately do an amputation or a radiation therapy or possibly a second surgery? Or maybe I know I can get it clean, but I know I can't get it closed. So maybe I'm going to need a second stage wound closure procedure or a graft or something like that. So those are the kinds of things I want to know before, because trying to explain that afterwards is always very awkward to clients. You know, I'm sorry that we can't get your dog's wound closed, but we got all the cancer out. Or the other is, I don't think we're going to get your dog's wound closed, but my goal is to get all the cancer out. And here's my plan for closing. Question.
In your experience, are there some tumors that you know of where you can go and get a sample
through finding a hospital? In my experience, do I know, are there some tumor types where it's very difficult to get a good sample through a fine needle aspirate? Yes, and sarcomas are one. They don't exfoliate as well as epithelial tumors. But 9 times out of 10, you still get cells. And sometimes it's equivocal and you can't tell, or you're just getting blood. I mean, that happens a lot. And so what's the next step? Biopsy. If we don't know what it is, right? Instead of removing it without knowing what the surgical dose should be. And I'll explain why that's so important, because I know intuitively we love the one-stop shopping kind of idea. Hey, we can get it out. We know what it is. We'll know what the margins are. But why that's dangerous, especially with sarcomas. Okay, so good. That was a very good question. Thank you for asking that. So sarcomas are a little bit harder, but oftentimes, especially with suction in the syringe, you can almost, 9 out of 10 times I'll get it. But not always. So. You can change your needle size. You can use an 18 gauge rather than a 22. I usually use a 22 and a 6cc syringe. That's my typical little setup. You can try that. You can try just doing the needle stabbing thing, because sometimes you'll actually core a piece out and be able to get that on a slide. And sometimes your best efforts are just, you know, you can't do it. You need something more, like a biopsy. Okay, so one of the things we answer the question about what is it? It was fine needle. The other is biopsy. And I guess I would like to kind of define biopsy as two different things, because it means something different to different people depending on what you're talking about. Sometimes we say we're going to biopsy a tumor. What we mean is we're going to remove it and send it in for histopathology. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'd say there's two sort of biopsy definitions. One would be pre-treatment biopsy, which is the stuff I'm talking about, a diagnostic biopsy, meaning figuring out what we're dealing with prior to initiation of definitive surgery or therapy of any kind. So usually it's taking a little piece of the tumor in whatever way we can. Versus post-treatment biopsy, which is what we're doing when we remove it and then send it in. And there are good reasons to do both, okay? There are definitely indications for both, but we want to be sure we know why we're doing what we're doing. And I would say that when we would need a pre-treatment biopsy, when fine needle aspirate confirms malignancy or is questionable and the following criteria are met, that the type of treatment would be altered by knowing what we're dealing with, that the extent of treatment would be altered by knowing the results of the biopsy, that the tumor would be is in a difficult location to resect, so before we go messing around with that area, like the face or the perianal region or something like that, we better know what we're dealing with so we know we got one shot at getting this out without disfiguring the dog. We better take it. And then knowledge of the tumor type would change the owner's willingness to go forward. So let me just kind of give you some examples. So here is a dog with a mediastinal mass. What are the two big differentials? Lymphoma, thymoma. How do we treat thymoma? Surgery. How do we treat lymphoma? Good. Chemicals. Chemotherapy, right. So this is an example when the type of treatment would be altered by knowing what the tumor type is, right? When the type, we don't want to crack a dog's chest for something we can treat with chemotherapy, and vice versa, we don't want to treat with chemotherapy for something we know we're going to need surgery for. So when type of treatment would be altered. Okay, this is an ulcerated lesion on a dog's paw. Give me some differentials real quick. Histiocytoma, mast cell tumor, great. Histiocytoma require wimpy surgery or big surgery? Wimpy, right? Surgical emergency, because if we do nothing, sometimes they go away on their own, right? And mast cell tumor, wimpy surgery or big gun surgery? Big gun surgery, okay? Both are round cell tumors. We could do an aspirate of this and not be able to tell the difference. We might say, oh, this is round cell tumor, but I can't tell you whether it's histiocytoma or mast cell tumor based on this. And a pathologist may not be able to do it either. That's a situation when the extent of treatment would be altered by knowing what the tumor type is. We don't know what the surgical dose is till we do a biopsy. If we can do marginal excision on this as a histiocytoma, we're golden. But tell me how you are going to get good margins on this for a mast cell tumor without reconstruction. Or maybe amputation. And we better know that ahead of time. Okay? So that's when extent of treatment. This is a dog that has an amelanotic melanoma in his mouth. And it extends, I don't think I have, no. It extends up into his orbit. And so in order, this is in the maxilla. It's kind of hard to tell because it's so big. And so to remove this, it's going to require a maxillectomy, orbitectomy combined procedure. And this is a fairly dangerous procedure. It's one of those ones that definitely causes some sphincter factor going on in the OR. And, you know, we lose some of these guys on the table from hemorrhage, okay? About 20% of the time we can have mortality on the table. It's a dangerous surgery. There are some owners that would be very willing to undergo that surgery in the 6-year-old black lab for a cure, if it was going to cure. Because we leave him like this, we know what's going to happen. He has no quality of life, he can barely eat, okay? But those same people would not put their dog through a massive surgery like that if they knew he only had 4 months to live because he has melanoma, okay? So this is a situation when knowing the tumor type might change the owner's willingness to go forward, all right? So good reason to do a good biopsy. And this is just one where the tumor's in a difficult location for reconstruction. This could be anything. This could be, you know, nose under the fence. This could be some kind of autoimmune thingy, but this is a squamous cell carcinoma. It's going to require a nasal planectomy. And I think it's one of those things that we really want to know something about before we do, because we really want to give the owners some ideas about what the dog's going to look like. Do they want to do this? These are very hard to aspirate, obviously. It's not the kind of thing that we're usually going to get a good diagnosis on, because even with sedation and we aspirate this, this has got a lot of inflammation in it, and typically that inflammation is going to overpower some of the finer cytologic details. And so good reason to do a biopsy. This is, by the way, how these guys look after nasal planectomy. Not bad, but it's something that owners need to know about before we go messing around with that. Okay, so then there are times when we talked about pre-treatment biopsy being really helpful, when extent of treatment would be altered, when type of treatment would be altered, when owner's willingness to go forward be changed by knowing what the tumor type is, and when the tumor's in a difficult location for reconstruction. And then there's times when it would be completely crazy to do it. And this would be when your fineal aspirate's obviously benign. It's obviously a cyst. It's obviously a lipoma on fineal aspirate. No one in their right mind is going to do a biopsy in an obvious case like that, unless it's behaving weird, like it's not behaving like a lipoma. Same thing when knowledge of the tumor type would not change your surgical therapy. Testicular tumor. You know, no one's going to go in and open the testicle and do a little wedge biopsy, close it all up, and wait for it to come back. No, we're going to do a neuter, right? Same with a solitary splenic mass. Whether it's hemangiosarcoma, your treatment is splenectomy. If it's hematoma, your treatment is splenectomy. Why? Because tumors in the spleen bleed, whether they're benign, whether they're hematomas, whatever they are, they bleed, and that's life-threatening, so we remove them. We wouldn't open the dog up, go ahead and get the splenic biopsy, close the dog up, wait for histopath, and go back in and remove it, because it's not going to change our treatment choice. It's going to be splenectomy no matter what that comes back as. And, go ahead. Liposarcomas will not look the same on an aspirate as a lipoma. And that's a very good question. So liposarcomas look like a sarcoma on an aspirate if you get a good sample. They don't look like a lipoma. You know, typical lipoma, blow it on a slide, put it in the diff quick, and nothing's left on the slide. Liposarcomas will have cells. And the other thing about liposarcomas is they won't behave like a lipoma. So we always say there's three reasons to remove lipomas, you know, if it bothers the dog, if it bothers the owner, a recent rapid growth. So they're going to behave differently. They're going to be growing all of a sudden. And so if you're getting lipoma on something that's growing and not behaving, then it's time to do it's not acting like a lipoma. It's not consistent with your diagnostics. Time to do more diagnostics. So it's a great question. But in fact, liposarcomas look like sarcomas when you do an aspirate, if you get a good aspirate. So other times when pretreatment biopsies would not be indicated is when the biopsy procedure is as difficult or as dangerous as definitive removal. Example, brain. No one's going to do a craniotomy, get a little biopsy, close up the skull, wait for the path. Oh, okay, we have a brain tumor. Because just getting there is just as dangerous. We got to get it out. We're going to go in there. So in that case, excisional biopsy is indicated. Everybody has to have a trophy slide. This is my trophy slide. This was in a 35-pound Labrador, so a little lab. This tumor weighed, I think it was finally like 18 pounds or something. I actually could not deliver this tumor through a standard laparotomy incision. I had to actually do a pericostal, like I had to do the laparotomy and then open pericostally just to get the thing out of there. What's your guess, benign or malignant? Benign, why? She's still alive, right? Yeah, so this poor owner was told, oh, this is a giant tumor, and the dog's going to be dead in, you know, 3 months because it's surely a hemangiosarcoma, and that wasn't the case, and this turned out to be a fibroma. And amazing that it never, like, burst and bled, but it was probably about ready to do so. Okay, a good example of one where we wouldn't go in and do a pretreatment biopsy here, right? We wouldn't do a craniotomy and get a little piece of this, close it up, wait for histo to come back, and then go back in. In fact, this is not a resectable lesion at all. Okay, so, all right, we kind of just talked about this. If the fineal aspirate's suspicious and tumors located in an area where wide margins are not possible, then preoperative biopsy is often helpful. We want to make sure that we do plan our biopsy tracks so that we can remove them at the time of definitive surgery. And when we do definitive surgery, we also want to plan our surgery so that we're making sure that we have our options for reconstruction mapped out, plan A, plan B, plan C. And also, if we know that radiation or some other adjuvant modality might be used, that we optimize the incision so that that modality is used in the most appropriate way. And I'll kind of give you some examples, I hope, of this as we go. So we want to make sure the entire biopsy tract or scar is able to be removed when the tumor is resected. So no transverse incisions on the limbs. Don't do that. Ideally, just to be accountable, the person who is planning to do the definitive surgery should really be doing the biopsy, because then they have to think about how they're going to orient their incision so it makes it easy to take out. Unlike fine needle aspirate, where tracking of cells in fine needle aspirate spots are very rare, in biopsy, when we do incisional biopsies or true cut biopsies, you can always find tumor cells along that biopsy tract. So if you leave the biopsy tract in, you're still leaving tumor cells in. So that biopsy tract has to come out when the definitive tumor removal occurs. We want to avoid contamination of uninvolved tissue planes. This is just good oncologic surgery principles. Use hemostasis so we don't get a big tumor, you know, big hematoma in this incisional biopsy, and then it spreads tumor cells in distant places. Close dead space. Use new instruments for additional procedures. So, you know, we have these three masses that we decide we're going to do biopsies on. So we do Mass 1, and then we do Mass 2, and then we do Mass 3, and we're using the same instruments. What if this one was a mast cell tumor and these two are sebaceous cysts? Well, we've just seeded two other areas then with the same instruments. Doesn't mean you have to open a new pack every time. For every tumor, just separate your instruments out. Even consider changing your gloves, okay? Good flushing, all that stuff. Just good principles. Okay, what is it? We talked about fine needle aspirate and biopsy. Where is it? Where else do we look for sarcomas? Well, we said they tend to metastasize by hematogenous routes, so they're usually going to end up in the lungs before anywhere else. There definitely are cases where they go to the lymph nodes. They don't all read the book, and so always check lymph nodes too, but we're more commonly going to see them in the lungs first. And then the question was, how bad is it? So we want to know, where is it? What is it? Where is it? And then how bad is it? How bad is it in soft tissue sarcomas usually relates to how fixed is it to underlying structures, what other structures are nearby. If you have a soft tissue sarcoma at the base of your heart, it's a little different than having it at the base of your tail, okay? So what else is there? Can we remove this? Is it possible to get wide? And when we say wide, we mean 2 to 3 centimeter margins, including deep. Is that possible? And what is the tumor grade? Because we said grade 1 through 3, and grade 3 is bad. Well, grade 3s tend to met. Grade 1 is hardly ever met. So if we get them all clean locally, then we don't have to worry about them coming back distant from their site. But if grade 3, even if we do great surgery, we get all the cancer cells out, some of those dogs will develop metastatic disease down the road. And how are we going to delay or prevent that? So once we've answered those big three questions, what, where, and how bad is the tumor, then we want to know what the optimal treatment pathway is. And we want to determine that plan before laying a scalpel on the skin. And so how do I define that? Well, in basic terms, and this is a little like philosophical, so bear with me here, is that the optimal treatment pathway or plan is the best treatment pathway in an individual cancer patient that provides A, optimum tumor control locally, minimum risk of spread, minimum morbidity, best quality of life, minimum trauma. And it's different for everyone. It's different for every soft tissue sarcoma. It's different for every hemangiosarcoma. And so that's why we need to know those three questions about that patient in order to be able to make the best plan for that patient with that tumor, because it's not the same as the previous patient with the same tumor. It's always going to be different. And, you know, we're taking into account owner's concerns, owner's wishes, etc. So things that I would be asking myself about the optimum treatment pathway, how do I know what the optimum treatment pathway is for this animal? I would be asking myself, can I obtain clean margins? Can I render this patient completely disease-free with surgery alone? Or am I going to need something else like radiation? Will I need reconstruction? And if I do, am I going to shave for it? Am I going to do it at the same time? Am I going to wait till my pathology comes back? Am I going to stage these things? Do I need to refer it? Do I need more options from, you know, a consult? Do I need radiation? And will that be necessary? And if it is, how can I optimize the way I'm treating this animal, the way I'm orienting my incision so that I get minimum amounts of normal tissues that have to be irradiated to clean up what I'm leaving behind? Is function or cosmesis significantly altered? And if so, if I talk to the owner about that, are they still willing to go forward? Am I being realistic? Am I being honest with the owner about what I think the animal's quality of life will be? And have I prepared that client for the costs? Reconstruction's expensive, wound care is expensive, and possible morbidity associated with that tumor removal. And those are all things I want to be sure I'm asking myself before I do anything. So, for soft tissue sarcomas, the thing that we have to do is wide excisions. And the reason for that is that they are so tricky. They have that crab-like extensions that come out from the body, but then they also have this weird pseudo-capsule. And what that is, this is just sort of a low-power histo view, is sort of this cleavage plane between what the body of the tumor looks like and the normal-appearing and normal-palpating tissue. But indeed, there are oftentimes these little microscopic crab legs that on higher power you'll see nests of sarcoma cells all out here. And if all we do is sort of peel them out along that cleavage plane that just kind of wants to happen, we're leaving disease behind. And why is that bad? I'll tell you why it's bad in a second. But the thing we want to do is never peel or shell these out. If we know it's a sarcoma, it's just going to be insufficient. It's treating a big gun tumor with wimpy surgery, just like treating a big gun infection with wimpy antibiotics. What do you get? Super infection. Same thing happens, and I'll explain here in a minute. So what I'm getting at is, you know, the first chance to cut is the best chance to cure, and especially with sarcomas. Why is that? Well, it's because the tumor bed's the smallest it'll ever be when it's a virgin tumor bed. Once you incise it, once you put your scalpel into tissues, once you dissect and interrupt tissue planes, every subsequent procedure that you do to remove any residual cells is going to be a bigger procedure. Does that make sense? I mean, there's no way that once you do a surgical excision and you have a scar there that then has microscopic disease, if you want to go in and get wider margin, that surgery is going to be much bigger the second time around, okay, and the third time around and the fourth time around. The other thing is that the body does a pretty good job at walling off things for a while. Tumors are tricky and they get aggressive and they invade, but for a while you've got some decent tumor barriers there, like muscle, like fascia. And if they're not touching that, sometimes we can get beyond those and get everything out, even if we're not 2 centimeters away. Okay? And then this is the thing where I'm talking about wimpy antibiotics and big gun infections. These crab legs that are in these soft tissue sarcomas, I talked about how there's that cleavage plane and we remove the tumor and we leave the crab legs in there. Well, basically, the crab legs, if you look at those histologically and do molecular markers and chemistry on them, what you find is that those cells are the most aggressive cells. Those are the cells that have upregulated all their cytoplasmic stuff to be able to invade. They're the ones that can get into the vessels and lymphatics and spread somewhere else. So if all we do is remove the cells in the middle of the tumor, we've left the most aggressive population of cells behind. They're the marines. They're the invasive ones. Those are the ones that when they repopulate and become a tumor, it's a worse tumor. That's why a lot of these, the more times you cut them out, the faster they grow back. Why is that? Because the tumor cells are getting sicker and sicker, and we're selecting for the most aggressive population over and over. And eventually what will happen is that it will metastasize, or it'll be so locally invasive, there's no way we can remove it. So it is not good medicine to just remove it and wait for it to come back when we know that those are the most aggressive population of cells. Question? That's a good question. And the question is whether using a laser will help with residual cells. And we know that laser electrocautery of a tumor bed does kill a couple of cell layers deep. So there is some advantage versus blade excision, but typically we're not talking about a couple cell layers. We're talking about nests of cells that are, you know, a centimeter away. Okay, so it's not going to do as good. And that's a common, misperception. We'll just ablate that area and maybe we'll kill everything that's left over. Good. Another question? Argon beam, again, I think the thing is how far are you going to get? If we're talking 1 to 2 centimeters away, and that's a lot of necrosis, so then we might as well just blade excise that far away. You know what I'm saying? So there is, to some extent, some advantage, and you can make an argument for benign tumors or like tumors that grow within cavities or like cysts and things like that, but not for malignancies and certainly not for soft tissue sarcomas. And this is true in the human world as well as in the veterinary world. Okay, so aggressive population. Don't leave the marines in. What we're doing, if we do wimpy surgery on a big gun tumor, is we're creating a super tumor, and that's exactly what happens. Another thing to keep in mind is that resection often results in very large defects. Let's see how we're doing on time. And so because of that, we want to, again, have our plans for reconstruction. And, the thing that we don't really want to do is we don't want to compromise our margin for fear of not getting the tumor bed closed, okay? Again, we don't want to leave that population of cells in there. And not only that, but if we find out that it's dirty, whatever excision attempt we do afterwards is going to be bigger than the first one. So we got one shot at this, and we want to plan it right, so that we can get the best, least morbidity for the patient, best cure possibility, et cetera. And so, in human medicine, they have like the tumor removing guys and they have the reconstruction guys. And they're two totally separate teams. And they do this on purpose so that they don't compromise tumor excision for fear of not getting the wound closed. And they hate each other. They don't high five going in and out of the OR. They don't send each other Christmas cards. They hate one another, but it's to protect the patient. So they have meetings ahead of time. They say, well, how big are you going to make it? Well, I'm going to make it this big. Well, here's what our reconstruction options are. But those reconstruction guys, they always have like plan B and C because they know that those surgeons lie. They're always bigger. And so like you have to split your mind in half, be the split personality. And we want not to compromise our good margins for fear of not getting it closed. So what does that mean? A, we gotta talk to the owners about this. We gotta prepare for the possibility of dehiscence. We have to also prepare the patient, clip enough hair. I mean, how many times does that happen? Like, you're pulling it together and the hair's, in your field and you're like, oh God, You know, it didn't look like it was going to need this. So be ready for that. Clip more than you think you're going to have to clip. Talk to the owners. And I think that owners are okay. Like, I've had so many people shake my hand or give me gifts because I've said to them, look, my job is to get every cancer cell out. And if that means that we're going to be coming back for second stage surgery or wound care or something like that, then so be it. But that's what it's going to take. Otherwise, we're facing amputation. Or otherwise, we're facing $5,000 in radiation costs. And the owners are like, thank you very much. But if I hadn't said that ahead of time, and then they had dehiscence, they'd be hating me. So it's all about prepping the owner also, and prepping the patient, making sure you're clipping enough. So I did want to show you this. This is a dog that had this big stifle tumor. I mean, this is a soft tissue sarcoma, had been previously biopsied and dehisced, and tumors popping out of there. But we actually got clean margins, even though we didn't get very deep. We had a nice fascial plane under here, and the tumor was movable on top of that, so it wasn't touching it. We got underneath that fascial plane. We got clean margins. We inked our margins to make sure our pathologist checked it. But now we're left with this pretty big hole, and I don't think anybody could just get this closed primarily. But we were ready for that. We knew that that would happen. And so what we did was just a flank fold reconstruction technique. But you can see how much hair we had to shave knowing that we were going to have to do that. Okay? And we had to prep the owner, and we had to prep them for the possibility that there could be dehiscence, and sure enough, there was. This is the dog. The very last few centimeters of the wound flap kind of necrosed. And, oh, I forget this dog's name. It was a cute name. But the owner was like, it dehisced just like you said it would, Doc. You know, he thought that was great, that I had predicted that. And I'm like, yeah. I always take credit where I can get it. So the other thing we want to do is we really, really want to know about our margins. Like, we don't want to just stick our head in the sand and go, oh, God, I hope it's clean, but we're not going to find out. We really want to know. And I know that there are a lot of path labs right now that charge extra for... How many people have a path lab that charge extra for evaluating margins? There is a huge problem with that, in my opinion, because it's a disincentive then to check your margins. And I think all these pathologists, you know, they're just, especially academic pathologists, are up in arms about that because they think that's just bad medicine. It's bad medicine. You should always have your margins. If you're doing an excisional biopsy of any malignancy, your margins need to be checked. You need to know, did you leave cancer in the patient or not? Is it going to grow back? And if it grows back, is it going to be the Marines? We need to know these things. So we have to help our pathologists too. And part of it is we have to give them a good history. We have to give them the whole specimen. Okay? We have to ink. So inking our surgical margins, you just use India ink from the art supply store, or their tissue inking kits that you can buy that are specifically for this. Submit the whole specimen. Clean margins are not always equal. So, you know, if somebody says, well, it's 3 cell layers away from the tumor, but it's clean, that's different than saying there is a centimeter of normal tissue between you and the tumor. If it's 3 cell layers or 1 millimeter away from the tumor, there's no way that pathologists can look at every edge, every single area. So I'd be a lot more worried about that one recurring, and I might consider doing some kind of adjuvant option or recut on that one than I would with an animal that had a centimeter of normal tissue between the tumor and the cut edge of the specimen. Again, important to address dirty margins as soon as they are known. And we have to recut the entire surgical wound bed with larger margins. Anywhere where your instruments have touched, you potentially have seeded cancer cells anywhere in there. So it's not just the caudal margin was dirty, so we're only going to resect the caudal margin again. Unfortunately, the whole tumor bed has to be resected again. And that's why the first chance to cut is your best chance to cure, because you may not be able to get it closed this next time, okay? Or you might not be able to get it all. And then when we can't get it, then we do have radiation therapy. It's a very, very effective tool, just very expensive. But if we wait till it recurs, it ensures that it's going to be more aggressive and difficult to treat. Why? Because they're the Marines that are recurring. They're not the wimpy guys in the middle of the tumor. They're the worst cells that you could have possibly left in there. Those are the ones that are recurring. Okay, and sometimes we know that clean margins are not going to be possible. I mean, this dog came in. This is a hunting dog. I think it was a German Shorthair Pointer. And his tail is over to the side, and his anus is like pointing that way because he has this perianal mass that the veterinarian thought was a lipoma, and then he thought it was a necrotic lipoma because it kept getting bigger, and he stuck a needle into it, and he just got lipoma stuff out. So he thought it was a lipoma, but wasn't behaving like a lipoma because it kept getting bigger and bigger. So then he thought it was maybe a necrotic lipoma, so he lanced it, and out of it came sort of this mucousy goo, And then it kept growing, so he thought, well, there's still stuff in there, so he lanced it and lanced it and lanced it. And meanwhile, it's getting bigger and bigger, and now it's the size of a basketball. And this dog stages clean elsewhere, no other disease elsewhere, and we do a biopsy of this, and it's a myxosarcoma. Myxosarcomas are a soft tissue sarcoma, like the ones we've been talking about, but they create this ground substance, and it looks like mucus. It looks kind of like snot. And it drains out of it, or like, you know, you don't always get a good fine needle aspirin on that one because there's so much ground substance, you don't always get good cytology. So that's a good reason to do a biopsy. Anyway, I'm looking at this dog going, I don't even know if I can, I mean, his rectum's turned 90 degrees, and I mean, it went way in there. We did a CT and everything, and I mean, I'm not going to get clean margins on this. I know this from the beginning. So what's my next best option? We can use radiation therapy. And in fact, this is what we did. We did a marginal excision, because we knew that we would not get all the tumor cells out, and then we irradiated this area. This dog had no time with this in. He really couldn't poop. He was obstructed. He could poop after this, and he went on to get radiation therapy. He did go on to get local recurrence about 8 months down the road. I felt that was probably going to happen because I couldn't even get down to microscopic disease here. I was leaving. I knew what was gross tumor behind, so I didn't think I was getting an ideal resection, but he had, you know, no time here. So we gave him decent quality of life for 8 months, and the owner was very happy, but obviously this could have been treated very differently, maybe with a very different outcome. So we do use radiation therapy commonly in the treatment of soft tissue sarcoma, especially when we like it to be with planned cytoreduction. So it's in a situation where we know we're not going to get clean margins, or the owner won't permit an amputation, which would have been required to get clean margins, or something like that, and then we're going to get down to microscopic disease where we have no disease left, and then we'll use radiation to clean up what we've got left. We use it that way. That's ideal because then we can orient our incision the right way. We can plan with the radiation therapist so that we know we're going to minimize exposure of of normal tissues to radiation as much as possible. But we also use it when we get unintentional dirty margins. And it doesn't matter how good you are. There are times when 2 centimeter margins or 3 centimeter margins away from the tumor, no matter how diligent you are and how great of a surgeon you are, that you still get fooled. These tumors can go beyond that. They're not all going to read the textbook. And I talk to owners about that. I say, you know, we can do the best job. We still may get dirty margins, and then we're going to need something else, either another cut or we're going to need further treatment like radiation therapy. If we know we're going to use radiation therapy, we can plan our reconstruction appropriately so that we don't end up having to do radiation on areas that we wouldn't have had to, that we had choices on. Good example of this is, for example, fibrosarcomas in cats. It's between the shoulder blade, and we're not going to go into the whole vaccine-associated thing in this lecture, but if you excise them from, you know, shoulder to shoulder across the kitty's back, and you get dirty margins, in order to irradiate them, they have to irradiate the entire chest cavity, which is a bad thing for the lungs and the heart and things like that. If you orient your incision parallel to the spine, because of the spinous process being so tall in a cat, when they turn the cat and irradiate on parallel opposed beams, they can avoid a lot of the chest cavity. So if you know that radiation is going to be used, you can orient your incision in such a way that avoids radiating tissues that don't necessarily need to be irradiated. Okay, and may be very bad for the patient to irradiate them. So the other thing is when you know that radiation is going to be used, you really have to plan your reconstruction such that there is no tension. Because anything that would predispose a wound to dehiscence without radiation therapy, like tension or, you know, big seromas and things like that, you can guarantee will cause dehiscence if you're going to radiate them. So we want to make sure there's no tension. We want to make sure we use tension-relieving techniques and allow some healing time prior to starting radiation therapy. Why does radiation therapy work for tumors? Well, basically what we do is high doses, but we use them in very small fractions. And what happens is the tumor can't repair, but normal tissue can. So the tumor cells are sick to begin with, and then when we irradiate them, we hurt their DNA even more. They can't go into repair mechanisms, but normal tissues can. So, yes, we hurt the normal tissues, but those can repair, and tumor cells don't. So that's what distinguishes them from the normal tissue. We do want to make sure that we use good patient planning, that we use a good radiation team. You know, a lot of times we're going to need advanced imaging. Most radiation facilities use what we call computerized planning, so that usually requires advanced imaging like CT or something that then goes into the computer and calculates the way that they need to treat it so that they can avoid treating the chest cavity. So this is a good example of what I was telling you about. See, you could treat this tumor down to here without getting any lung, but if the incision was from here to here and you had to treat that whole scar, you'd have to treat most of the lung, okay? So that's kind of just some basics about radiation therapy. And so it's worth a call to the radiation folks near you or whoever you're going to be referring to and just say, you know, I just want to make sure I'm planning this right and, you know, anything I need to know, and they'll help you. And we need to educate our owners because acute effects go away. Late effects are bad. Acute effects are the things like the skin sunburn and stuff like that. The late effects are things like cataracts or, you know, lung fibrosis and stuff. So we want to know what's going to be in the field. How is that going to affect the patient's quality of life from here on out? How long will the acute effects last? And those kinds of things we want to counsel owners on before they make the decision. But again, it's a big deal to go radiation therapy, and it's expensive too. And so if we can avoid that, be great. And we probably can avoid it more times than you think just by good preoperative planning and answering that what is it, where is it, how bad is it question. So it's very effective. In fact, if we have microscopic disease, there's a 90% chance control at 1 year, 80% chance of local control at 2 years. And many times we cure them, even with microscopic disease, with radiation and surgery. Again, we probably can cure a lot of these guys with surgery alone if we just plan appropriately, but when that can't work for whatever reason, either the tumor's too big or we've done something that compromised that optimum treatment pathway and we no longer can get clean margins, then radiation's a handy tool to have. And we like to use it as a planned postoperative adjuvant rather than unplanned dirty margins. I'll skip this interest of time, but there is chemotherapy. We use chemotherapy, or we actually recommend chemotherapy in our animals that have these grade 3 tumors. We know that in grade 3 tumors, about half of those dogs will metastasize. So we don't have the ability to know, though, which half of the grade 3s will and which half won't. So we always recommend it. Whether or not it's going to help every animal, we don't know. But it's something we give the owner the option for. Okay, help them to make an informed choice. And, there's a whole bunch of different protocols. Probably the Adria-based protocols are the most common. There's doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, there's mitoxantrone, there's carboplatin. There's a bunch of different protocols available. So what about prognosis? Grade's prognostic, so grade 3 is bad. Grade 1 is okay if you can get it all. Size, mostly because it's easier to remove small tumors than big tumors. And completely some margins. Those are the big ones. And let's see here. So real quick, summary slide, your tips for success. Mark your surgical margins. Wide aggressive excision. Conservative surgery leaves the most aggressive portion in the patient. Consider orientation of the scar and how it affects the ease of re-excision or radiation therapy, so help plan. And address dirty margins as soon as you know they're dirty. Don't let the Marines repopulate the wound. That's the big questions. Any questions? That's a great question. The question was, have we used radiation preoperatively to shrink it down? And yes, and there's a whole lecture on sort of the pros and cons of that. But yes, it can be used as a preoperative downstaging kind of situation. And there's some advantages to that. So we can talk more about that. But whether you use it in the preoperative setting or postoperative setting, usually we'll use it in the preoperative setting if we know we don't have a chance at clean margins. Same situation applies, though. If we're going to operate on a preoperatively irradiated site, no tension, problems with wound healing, that kind of thing, but we just have to plan for that. But it's very possible to do, and we do it probably less commonly than post-op, but we do it. So, very good question. Other questions? Okay, we'll see you in a few minutes for lecture 3.